Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
You will listen to an interview about transition finance and how we can use climate bonds and green bonds to finance the regenerative agriculture revolution and help millions of farmers and land users switch practices. There's a $100 trillion bond market waiting for financial products. Welcome to another episode of Investing in Regenerative Agriculture, Investing as if the planet mattered, a podcast show where I talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why am I focused on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land, grow our food and what we eat. And it's time that we, as investors, big and small, and consumers, start paying much more attention to the dirt slash soil underneath our feet. Before we get started, I've been recording these interviews next to my day job, and I will definitely continue to do so, and release about an episode a month. But at the same time, I would love to take this further, share more interviews. There are many more stories to share on investing in regenerative food and agriculture. More depth, improve the quality, maybe even doing some video series. So I started a Patreon community, which makes it easy to support creators like myself. If these podcasts have been of value to you, and if you have the means, I invite you to support me and make this happen. For more information, please find the link to my Patreon account in the description below. And now, without further ado, the interview. Enjoy! Welcome to a new episode. I'm Koen van Zijen, your host, and in the podcast today, I'm interviewing Sean Kidney, co-founder of the Climate Bonds Initiative, an international investor-focused non-for-profit. They are the only organization working solely on mobilizing the $100 trillion, yes, that's a T, bond market for climate change solutions. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you for having me on.
So to start with a personal question, what brings you to climate bonds? And let's try also to answer the question, what is a climate bond for anybody that's not from that space?
Sure. Well, understanding bonds in terms of what we have to do for climate change, we have to do a lot of capital shifting. You know, we've got about various numbers, but let's say roughly $90 trillion we have to invest between now and 2050 in climate solutions. Some of that is reorienting capital, that is water investments that are non-climate ready, into becoming water investments that are climate ready. Some of that is new. It is a high capex transition. As you know a lot about climate change, your listeners do, we are currently still, after 30 years of jawboning and talking, on a path to, I'm going to call it species extinction. And I don't just mean the species and the planet that we're wiping out of fire straight. I mean the human species. You know, we're looking at air density of GHGs at the end of the century of about 800 ppm versus 415 ppm now. A really stuffy room after 3 hours of meetings, if no windows open, is about 1,000 to 800 ppm. The whole planet will feel like a stuffy room. You know how your brain doesn't work after 3 hours in one of those rooms? Well, that's what it'll feel like living on the planet. We don't know if humans can survive in that kind of air. And there's a good chance that after a couple hundred years, we won't. Let alone all the other reasons why the species would be under threat. So that's the current trajectory. We have to change that trajectory. As if anyone has read the IPCC report last year, will know the change graph we have to achieve now is very, very sharp. It is a U-turn. It is no longer a right-hand turn because of the extent to which emissions have gone up in the last 30 years. We've put in more CO2 into the atmosphere in the last 30 years than the previous 150 years, while we've been talking about it, of course. So that's what we're faced with. Now, if you need to make this kind of change in an economy and a planet and society, there are large capital needs. It is a very high capex path. Take solar, low opex, high capex. That means a lot of capital up front. That means interest rates are critical for these investments. Two-thirds of the cost of a solar plant in a place like India is interest over its lifetime. But the rewards are great. That is, we do have low OPEX solutions. And, of course, things like solar have a life beyond the 20-year financing life. They keep generating energy for another 10 or 20 years after that. So this is the challenge we face ourselves in. Vast capital flows needed to achieve a planet where our children have some kind of future. You can't do that without the bond market, the way we're currently constructed. Well, you could. If we were at war, if someone was invading our beaches and pointing guns at us, we would probably shift to a wartime economy where we rapidly mobilize every single resource around and borrow heavily from someone else. You'd do it. That's what happened in World War II in the US and Europe, and let alone in the Axis countries. But the trouble with climate change is it's not quite immediate. It's a few years off. It's always a few more years. We're feeling the impacts of climate change now and weather volatility of all sorts, but we ain't felt nothing yet. This is just the beginning. The CO2 that's in the atmosphere already will continue to deliver us increased weather volatility for the next 30 years. Even if we stopped all CO2 tomorrow morning, it would still get worse and worse and worse for 30 years because of the latency affecting the atmosphere. So bond markets are about $100 trillion outstanding globally. Equity markets are $60 trillion. Gives you a flavor of the difference. Bond markets are pension funds, insurance, government bodies, banks. These are different types of investors to equity investors a lot of the time. They tend not to be watching the stock, the S&P, every day, especially amongst the institutional investors that have a long-term appetite, pension funds and insurance funds. There are a lot of buy-and-hold investors. Now, if you're trying to do a CapEx investment with a long return on investment profile, this is the perfect investor class for you. And we need to get them into the game. At the moment, they're only marginally exposed to what I'd call solution sectors. And in the sectors that need to become solution sectors, we need to change practices, they're not largely aware of what's involved. In other words, they can't differentiate between a water utility that is doing capital investment which is climate ready versus capital investment which is not climate ready and frankly might fail anyway as it becomes a credit risk because of the weather volatility we're going into, the rainfall volatility. So this is the space to work in. We need to get energy and enthusiasm for that market. We need to create enabling frameworks. We need to identify what are the right investments on the ground, make it clear and simple. And that's what we're trying to do. Now, a green bond, a climate bond, is essentially a standard bond where the proceeds go to one of these investments that are seen as priority investments to address climate change. Of course, it's not exclusively climate change. It's also a range of other environmental investments. In the sense that climate change isn't just about mitigation. Climate change is about how we manage our planet. It's about resilience. It's about adaptation. It's about stewardship. It's about sustainability. It has to be. I mean, climate change is fundamentally a failure of sustainability, a species failure, if you like. So that's what a bond is. And it's quite important to note that the way we've constructed this market is that these bonds are the same as any other bond. We can't afford a niche market here. We have to be able to engage the mainstream portfolio managers around the world. So these bonds walk and talk like an ordinary bond, similar yield, similar coupon. The distinguishing feature is a promise by the issuer, governed by an international framework, to allocate the proceeds to qualifying investments. We'll come back to qualifying investments later. And now we've got about $600 billion outstanding of these globally and a rapidly growing market.
And a huge interest, right, in terms of investors. It's not that you're pushing this and you have a hard time.
Well, the Dutch.
Yeah, tell us about that.
The Dutch sovereign bond that came out a couple of weeks ago. And look, anyone can issue bonds. You get all kinds of rating levels from cities, corporations, banks, and governments. The Dutch sovereign bond went looking for €4.5 billion of orders. It's a green bond certified by the Climate Bonds Initiative. And they got $21 billion onto their order book. That was a success. For them, it was fantastic. Now, that case, the proceeds are being allocated to adaptation investments that the Dutch government has made. You all know what it is, the Rotterdam investments to manage extreme flood incidents and so on. So that's an example of what's happening. Now, we haven't seen a lot in the agricultural space, but we have seen some, and we'll come to it. So that's what we're trying to do, right? I don't think I've answered all your questions, but I'll stop there for a minute.
Yeah, I think it's extremely, there's a lot to unpack there, but it's extremely relevant to think, I would almost say, like, how do you, this huge transition, how do you tap into the fire hose of finance, where there's the real large scale potential, but of course they play with different rules compared to equity, compared to very, very short-term investments. This is a different beast, but absolutely essential if we want to get anywhere near the 90 trillion that you mentioned. And how did you get into the space? And how did you came to climate bonds as such an interesting career path?
Well, I had a midlife crisis about 12 or 15 years ago, I think it was. I'm a social entrepreneur anyway, so I was living in Australia. I had companies called Social Change Media, publishing companies and so on. One of my effectively non-profits of one sort or another, one of my companies went bankrupt. It was very depressing, a publishing company, because for a variety of macroeconomic conditions in Australia. And that throws you around after 15 years of success with it and debts and all those sort of things. And then my father died. This is all in short sequence. Then my father died. He took a long time to die. He was supposed to die overnight. He lasted a month in a hospital in southern New Zealand. And I was sleeping in the hospital and talking to him during the day, trying to get to know him before he finally got away, difficult character he was. And in a lot of the time that I had when he was sleeping, because he was slowly dying of cancer, I grabbed a couple of books on my shelf that I'd been for ages as I left Sydney to fly to see him in New Zealand, one of which was the Proceedings of the Catastrophic Climate Change, chaired by Tony Blair. And I thought, I knew a little bit about climate change. I'd worked at Greenpeace over the years. I was about to join the Greenpeace board. But I'm going to tell you, reading the scientific papers was sort of like a slow-mo horror movie. Because, well, as you know, wading through science papers is stultifying at times in terms of the careful language. And this has, of course, been one of the challenges of climate science, the desire to have careful, caution language. But then you look at this and say, hang on, I think this person is saying X, Y, and Z. And by the time I got to the book with 20 separate academic papers, I was thinking, my God, we don't actually have a future. This is unbelievable. This is way, way, way worse than anything that's appeared in the general literature, the media, frankly, let alone Greenpeace advocacy brochures that I'd obviously read because I was involved. This is actually this is species-defying. And I thought, yeah. I mean, I've got kids. I've got a future. And I said, it's a bit like, you know, when you open your eyes and you see the freight train coming down the track. You've got no choice but to try and figure out how to do something about the freight train. You've got no choice because that's the unfortunate aspect, or maybe the liberating aspect of awareness. And that led me to then try to think about what I was going to do after that. I had another incident soon afterwards, which is I had a stroke. It's a health-defying incident. I was in hospital for a week and I minor stroke, and I came out of it thinking, well, I'm going to die at any minute. I'd better do what it is that I think I need to do. And that led me onto this path. So that's the personal motivation. So this is a mission, not a career. We'll just keep working on it till the mind and the body fails. And you find a lot of people in climate change with a similar kind of mission to do something about it. And the more you read the science, the more you have the mission. That's the background. In my own case, I'd done a lot of work with the financial sector. And I've had a view that the developing role of institutional investment was an opportunity. In the Netherlands, this is the PGGMs and the APGs of the world, and there's a similar collection in Australia where I was living at the time. These are organisations that have a mandate for long-term investing. Governments are horribly caught up in short term. Even an enlightened Obama finds it difficult to get out of the short-term cycle pressure, and it's fast difficult to do things. We need new power blocks to the table. We need power blocks that understand the long-term issues in a way that corporations have lost in the last 100 years, 50 years, because they've been caught up with short-term dynamics. And, you know, you will get CFOs in the US in a survey a few years ago when asked, would they take a decision which was best for the company over 3 years, but not so good in 6 months, or one which is better for the share price of the company in 6 months, but not so good over 3 years, which one would they take? And they 80% took the second choice. That is short-term price
benefits. Which is quite shocking, yeah.
And we're trying to deal with a long-term problem here. I mean, yeah. This is like lunacy. So bringing long-term investors, and more to the point, making them aware of long-term issues when they often not aware, has got to be one of the opportunities for us to do something about that. And that led to moving to London to work on finance, the Climate Bonds Initiative, and this particular project. If you like, the engagement with bonds isn't just about creating instrument. That's a bit of a Trojan horse. That's a means towards an end. It's actually about engaging the investment community. Investment community become active to protect the interests of its beneficiaries in the long term, to make sure it can match that as its liabilities, because in a world of crazy climate volatility, it can't. And then get them to make sure the enabling environment. And I had a joyous moment recently when I read the new BNP Paribas Asset Management Sustainability Strategy. And on the back of that, Jane Ambekshire, as the new head of sustainability for BNP Asset Management, had written, our role will not only be to look at our investments in the context of sustainability and ensuring sustainability, but also to ensure the enabling environment and governments are acting in such a way that we can support the sustainability of our investors. Hallelujah. Every fund has to do that. I mean, I'm going to say the Dutch investment community is better than most. The French are getting there. The Germans are a long way behind. And in the US, it's half a dozen funds who are fantastic, and the rest are like 100 miles behind. So we've still got work to do. But the green bond, the climate bond market, and they're much the same thing, are getting their attention because it's giving them something they can do with their money that helps them talk to their internal and external stakeholders worrying about climate change, and that gets the internal organizational change underway.
So just to very clearly, I mean, you say it's a difficult discussion, but climate bonds versus green bonds, what are the differences? And is it important for investors to know?
No, not really. When the market started, there are a lot of different views about what could be a green bonds. In the US, there were investments that were weak in their environmental qualifications. In China, the focus was more on air pollution. One of our jobs globally has been to say, folks, there's nothing more important than climate. Everything is subsidiary. All these other matters will be addressed as part of it, but you've also got to have a climate filter. In other words, you don't want to do an investment in the US that looks good for short-term environmental reasons, but is not good from a climate perspective. That's counterproductive. You've got to be able to tick off both. And as a result, we now have a situation where globally, this market is largely a climate market, and that's becoming the focus. So it's not a big deal, the difference between the two. There's not really a substantive difference.
Okay, perfect. So let's switch to the agriculture part. So there's a forestry framework, or let's say land use in a broader context. So there's a forestry framework, which has been out. There's a protected agriculture framework specifically for Mexico, which I think is specifically focused on greenhouse, like the non-heated greenhouse structures, and you're working on an agriculture framework. Can you give a short overview of where we are in terms of climate bonds and land use and agriculture?
Well, clearly from a climate perspective, the agriculture sector is so important. In Europe, agriculture is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, for example. Working with the agricultural sector is a vital thing. Now, there are many things to be done. I mean, in many countries, we are still deforesting at a terrible rate. So stopping the release of carbon, stopping the mining of peat or the destruction of peat in many countries, which is the most intense form of greenhouse gases we have around, these are critically important things to do. We're not necessarily going to do these with direct investment. We're not going to stop deforestation by investing in a forest. There are many attempts to do red 2 bonds and so on, but the cash flows aren't there. There, we have to look at the economic development of the society around the natural capital assets and how do we make those richer and have a different economic path than the destruction of capital assets. That's the challenge.
Do you mean like a local, like let's say we're in Congo in the Democratic Republic, taking an extreme example. Would there be a bond issued by a local government or by the government to that then benefits from the non-destruction of the forest and is able to pay back, or how would that look like?
I'm separating out the bond issuance from the environmental challenge first. The first thing to do is to identify activities that achieve our outcome. Once you've done that, then you look at the potential for bond issuance in an area. Agricultural sector will always be relatively small in bond issuance. The big sectors will be infrastructure and buildings and energy. But it's critically important from an emissions perspective. So what I'm trying to say is that preservation of national capital is one. The increase in sequestration of soils and the regrowth of forests is another. As you would know more than most, the potential for soil sequestration is huge. The changing of practices to reduce emissions at a farm level is also important.
It's the reason I'm doing this podcast. Yeah. The reason why I got into the space, apart from that I like food, obviously, but the climate potential and the climate risk, honestly.
Correct. So all of that's going to be done. Now, the question is, what are practices that count? When we started looking at in underlying criteria, we had a lot of approaches from the OLEMs, the Nestles of the world, because they're the bond issuers. In the bond space, you need to be a reasonably large institution. That means a government, a bank, or a corporation to be able to do this. And then the money trickles down through their processes to smallest landholders or whatever. You're not going to be a coffee farmer in Ghana and be able to issue a bond, realistically. But you might get a green loan from a microfinance company who is able to issue a bond to refinance its portfolio of loans. We need to know what kind of loans count. We need some sort of rules. So the overarching most important area in terms of a climate is improvements in carbon stocks. That's one. And, of course, by implication, the reduction in carbon loss. How we manage that, how we measure that, that is challenging. Not a lot of people are measuring carbon in soil or even forests around the world. What we've done in Europe, we have been working on a European taxonomy of sustainable finance, which will be a regulated taxonomy for the European Commission to define investments.
I think some of the old podcast people around soil capital, Andrew, etc., are part of that discussion. There are some of the RegenEgg people are involved as well.
Yeah, we've involved a whole lot of experts in it. So there's a technical expert group, which I'm a member of, but we've involved 150 domain experts to give us advice in that area, including the Climate Bonds Initiative, technical expert group on agriculture. And in that area, we've ended up saying two things. One is the first thing is carbon, measuring and improving carbon stocks. If people can show evidence that they're doing that, bingo, that's going to be part of the solution. However, that's very difficult, not happening very often. So what we've ended up doing is having a basket of practices which are relatively short-term in nature but are seen to be consistent with improving carbon stocks. You know, zero-tilling agriculture, for example, as is seen from open plough. In Europe, if people can show that they are using that basket of practices, which are effectively proxies for the for activities that are or descriptions of activities that will improve carbon stocks, then that will count for the taxonomy. In other words, they'll be able to get access to green loans. If they're a large agricultural organization, they can do green bonds. That's how we're tackling it. It's very early days. It's relatively for conditions around the world. So the Mexican thing you talked about is where we looked at a specific request from a development bank in Mexico to define investments to be consistent. And what was interesting was the growth of the greenhouse sector in Mexico. These are not greenhouses like in the Netherlands. There's no power used to heat them. In other words, they're effectively using solar power to be able to increase productivity. And they're very effective. So in that case, because of a increased productivity with minimal energy use and also pesticides, mineral pesticides use, we've got a criteria around pesticides as a resilience issue, which I'll come back to, we've now been able to identify loans to greenhouses in Mexico that qualify, and the development bank has issued a bond accordingly to finance those sort of activities. So it's a complex, heterogeneous area, as you know, a lot of detail, being able to figure out what kind of investments count. It takes more work than, say, clean energy, but it is a critical area, and that's the journey we're currently on. The things you mentioned earlier are various components of that journey. There's something I need to say here. This is not just about mitigation. It has to also be about resilience. We've effectively lost the first half of the fight about climate change. We will have a century of extreme volatility compared to what we've experienced in the last couple of hundred years. That's going to mean floods, droughts, storms, and then all the consequent problems. I'll keep away from the societal impacts, but just in the field of agriculture, we need to be much more careful about water usage. Water scarcity will be the norm. Even in places that currently get water, the overall water availability may not change or may increase, but it will come in dumps. In other words, there will be droughts and floods and droughts and floods rather than steady rain. That's going to require a different approach to water management. So all the things we're doing in dry lands, we're going to need to start doing in wetlands too, just so we can deal with the periods between rainfall. These are critical investments for resilience, but it's a lot more than that too. We know that heat changes, that is, areas of the planet are going to be affected by intense heat periods, will have a dramatic effect on what can be grown in different areas. There's a whole pile of crops that 1 or 2 degrees extra heat at the wrong time, and they die. How do we adapt to that? We change our agriculture. We maybe need to move towards different variations of the crops we're currently planting. All of these are part of the change that we have to address, let alone what we started off saying, which is sequestration. The sequestration stuff I find interesting. What I'm fascinated about personally is the extent to which our consuming patterns need to change. They will be forced to change because the maize crop in Mexico will probably fail in the next 30 years. It won't be a maize-growing area unless we shift to a different kind of GM maize, and that'll change diets necessarily. But if we keep ahead of it, we already know that maize is a terrible crop for carbon sequestration. Actually, quinoa is a really good crop. It sequesters carbon very well. We've actually got a climate change reason to reconsider our dietary habits. One of the things I talk about with food companies is how you can contribute with marketing. You know, we do know, you know, we're all creatures of a consumer society. We get affected by advertising. We need to use this for good. We need to be encouraging people to eat quinoa, if you like, and to eat less maize. This is not very popular from Monsanto, who makes 90% of its profits from maize. But as far as the future we need to have for our children, these are important considerations. So there's a hell of a lot in the agriculture sector, as you know more than anyone, from the finance market. What we now need to do is to have a procurement list of stuff that counts, that works, some rules to make it easier for the finances, and then they can then decide, okay, I want to have my money in that side rather than that side because I'm worried about sustainability, and someone is helping me define what that means.
And what would be, like, the people listening to this show, which are investors, many of them personal investors, family offices, foundations, etc., but also the people working in this space, what should they know about climate bonds and green bonds? What should they, how could they interact? What would be your advice to them over the next years, as many hopefully will be structuring things or interacting with their local banks or with their local groups to issue these things? What are the key, let's say, 2 points they need to consider, as maybe before this call they didn't consider the bond market too much?
Look, there is now a bond market. It's moving into a retail market, senior notes for high net worth individuals, all sorts of instruments. You've seen 4 banks around the world issue retail deposit schemes so that if you have an account with UniCredit, you can actually, well, it's not available in Europe now. The ones that exist are Westpac in Australia, Yes Bank in India, Ned Bank, to switch your money over to the green account. It pays exactly the same interest, but Yes Bank promises to ring-fence the money and only allocate it to green solutions. Simple as that. And they raised $1 billion in 3 months with opening up that retail account. So there's a lot of different things coming out of the market. We all have the opportunity to vote with our checkbooks or our savings accounts in the future. This is where we're going. And with your investments, of course, you need to do the same thing. Now, it's a regulated, organized market. There are rules. It's like a fair trade coffee label market. And for that, it could be interesting because it'll facilitate easy decisions. You can get away without the intense examination of the underlying assets because there's now an infrastructure to develop that, and instead start looking at how your investments from a financial point of view would be keystone investments that might grow a market or support a company to be able to then tap larger slices of capital in the climate bonds and green bonds market. Remember, this is not really largely a market for small companies or small farmers or whatever, but there's a possibility of helping those to then scale up to get capital, or helping banks to scale up and issue bonds. And so if you're an investor, what's your strategic opportunity to do something bigger than your own investments is the question I always think people should ask. How, if I invest in this, can I create a ripple effect? if we've sorted out the rule sets or getting that sorted out, then it makes it a little bit easier to focus on the financial aspects of the ripple, as distinct from also worrying about the quality of agricultural practices, which is a big part of what we have to do at the moment.
And if you're on the other side, you're creating funds around this space, you're scaling up farmers, or you're putting a lot of farmers together, what would be your number one advice to them, the professionals in this space, with the boots on the ground, when looking or when thinking about climate bonds?
Well, crudely, if you're not across climate issues, you're missing a trick. So I'm assuming your listeners will be aware of this, but you know, we do have a world of climate volatility. Resilience has to become a factor we look at in everything now. We do have a world where continuing pressure on sequestration and the need to sequester will be the norm. So there's a policy risk issue to be addressed in some countries as well. That is, there'll be a shift to push the agricultural sector. Are you ahead of that curve? And then, of course, if you're mission-driven like you and I, then you're also looking for opportunities to maximize sequestration and maximize resilience in a way. I'm going to say this. Everything we do as individuals now in society, everything we do needs to be through the filter of how we can grow this rapidly, how we can catalyze other people to act in the same way. And that's the same whether you're a fund manager or a farmer in Africa. If you're aware of these issues, if you have the privilege to be able to understand the challenges we face, well, you have the privilege as a result to be able to find a way to act in your work. That's what I'd say is the overarching thing.
And you wanted to come back to pesticides. I don't know if we want to open a rabbit hole, but we want to go down there. But you wanted to say something on that.
Well, my point more was that we need to look at resilience. Resilience is actually more than just resilience against weather. It's about our ecosystem resilience. You know, complex systems, if they're hollowed out, collapse quickly and don't recover. We have hollowed out our global ecosystems. We need to work to make them more resilient by improving their biodiversity, by improving their ability to be able to respond to extreme climatic shocks and weather shocks we're going to have. That's essentially it. One of those issues is the use of artificial substances. We know that when you release a lot of antibiotics into the ecosystem, all sorts of changes happen. Animals die, bees disappear, and so on. These are examples of activities that are destroying resilience. By reducing our use of pesticides, we increase the biodiversity of the sector. We increase its capacity of resilience. Now, this is managed. I'm going to say we have to understand that we are in an anthropogenic world now. We have, for the last few thousand years, been effectively managing the global climate without realizing it. You can look back now at the Bronze Era, about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, and see that as bronze spread around Europe, we saw massive deforestation and we saw a significant increase in GHGs in the atmosphere, which is out of kilter with climatic changes. That's the first time we now realized we were affecting the atmosphere. In the 1500s, our invasion of the Americas led to the spread of smallpox and measles. 90% of all Indo-Americans died in that period. We saw massive forestry growth as a result of human activity. In the Amazon, it was vast. That sucks so much carbon out of the atmosphere that it contributed to 2 degrees cooling on the planet in the 1600s, in a way that's mildly optimistic in terms of the potential for forestry growth contribution. But whatever, we then experienced climate change in the 1600s, which meant, on a day-to-day basis, war, famine, and pestilence, and we lost a third of the world's population. So we've been managing the planet without realizing it. We've been actually doing this blind, like juveniles in a forest kicking down trees. We now need to do it with our eyes open, and we need to be looking at all aspects of stewardship of the planet. It's not just agriculture. It's, of course, how we manage our relationships with other species. It's how we manage our oceans, which we've been depopulating for the last 100 years with dramatic collapses of fisheries around the planet. These are all issues we have to address in what now has to be a conscious and our thinking and thoughtful stewardship of the world we have inherited. We are here. We are not going to voluntarily die, although we may commit suicide. That's one of the paths we're on now. So while we're here, we need to change the way we work. The use of artificial substances is a challenge for us. It has been killing ecosystems. So therefore, we need to change how we use it. It doesn't mean we won't use artificial substances. On the contrary, we have to be very measured and be thinking of the wider impacts. And everything we do at the moment seems to be focused around short-term gain. Running the planet sustainably, being a steward of the planet, cannot be focused around short-term. It has to be taking 100-year decisions. And that's the change we're in the middle of at the moment.
Yeah, I think it comes back nicely to the point of the need of transition finance, because these farmers, these land users, they can get off these substances for the most part, and in some cases even completely, but they need through that phase of, some people say 5, some people say 10 years, some people say 3, depends on the land, of course, what has been used before. But they need to be helped, and actually climate bonds at the large scale, or transition finance on the more local scale, is needed for many to go through that path of a number of years of getting off the drugs and basically revitalizing the land, or actually making it adaptive again, or making it actually alive again to grow something.
So the way this works in Mexico is that the FIRA loans comply with a pesticides protocol as well. That is significantly reduced pesticides. If you're a farmer with a greenhouse in Guadalajara and you want to get a loan from FIRA, you need to show that you are not using pesticides beyond the minimal acceptable level. So it translates into concrete criteria, and as a result, you can get a loan. What we're working around globally is to make those loans cheaper, with development banks providing credit support, with governments providing regulatory support. The lending to the green sector will be materially cheaper than lending to non-green sectors. So it'll be a direct financial incentive. Now, you might be a farmer in somewhere like Italy, and you're concerned about these issues, but you're trapped because you try to raise money and run something in a marginal way. You'll be able to get cheaper capital from UniCredit because it's green. That's where we're going on this, and you'll see that unfolding. We've already seen it happening in other sectors. In the building sector, a number of banks around Europe, including in the Netherlands, are offering cheaper capital for green homes. That is, if your home is a very energy-efficient home, you'll get a lower interest rate on your mortgage. Or if you take out a loan for energy efficiency in places like Germany, you effectively pay zero interest. This is the way we're going with everything. We need to take it way beyond clean energy and buildings where it already occurs into agriculture. And it's where you drive a change. If you're in a farmer in the Congo and you're dealing for microfinance company and buying seed, you're going to get a cheaper interest rate if you buy seeds that are consistent with what we're talking about. And our challenge is to make those rule sets simple and clear enough that they can be implemented at a microfinance level in the Congo.
And if you, final question, if you could change one thing overnight, if you could wave your magic wand and change something in, let's say, the land use and agriculture industry, what would it be? What would we see tomorrow? We wake up and Sean has changed something. What would it be?
Wouldn't it be great to be able to walk around a landscape and know, as if you're wearing one of those Google glasses, what's good and what's bad? Wouldn't it be great to have simple understanding across societies that we're around the world of what are the right practices and the wrong practices? None of us know. We need help with that. So that'll be one thing I think that could make a huge difference, because the truth is everyone wants to try and do something whilst also making a living for themselves. And that would help. For the finance sector, that would be incredibly useful, because so many financiers are now concerned about long-term outcomes. They're trying to shift their money, but it's really hard. So it's not just a credit issue. It's also actually understanding what are the right things to be doing in the context of challenges we face in different kinds of environments around the planet, because there are so many different kinds of environments. That would be one thing I'd say. But, you know, what do we really need? We need governments that act like they're at war. We need governments that realize that this is a freight train looming down them and take all the steps necessary as if someone was invading the beaches to make the changes. That's what we really need.
Yeah, but it would help if the carbon pump, if you could see carbon being sequestered in one field compared to another one. Well, they seem to be the same, but actually one has completely different practices and is contributing to the solution and the other one isn't. Making that visible, making the invisible visible there would, I think, at least for a lot of people in the agriculture sector, help a lot.
And by the way, I think we're beginning to see a bit of that. We've got an inkling now with satellite technology, with tracking.
I know, it's super exciting.
You know, we will see that in the future, and that will translate into differential financing. I mean, one of the projects that I was very keen on a few years ago, now replicated, Climate Corporation, which was bought by Monsanto, probably unfortunately, but it's still going. Now, it's a insurance company. It started off as a bunch of techies in California that were tracking satellite data about agriculture and providing information to farmers to make decisions on what they planted on the basis of, well, first of the readings of soil, moisture, and so on, and then linking that to expected weather. They moved into insurance. So when they were working, when I last saw them, they were offering instant payout insurance to farmers if their predictions about what they should invest in didn't deliver them a good return. So a farmer will choose to plant crop A instead of crop B because of Climate Corporation's advice based on satellite monitoring data. And if that didn't work and the crop failed, instant insurance payout. My God, we need that in the Congo. We need that in Indonesia. We need that everywhere. And there is some work doing that. Colombia, there's a project taking satellite data, feeding information to farmers. They now need to link it up with insurance schemes along these lines. Now, that level of data that we're getting from satellite systems and other systems is absolutely relevant and important to assessing what we're talking about here, which is carbon sequestration activities, which is water resilience, climate activities.
Reforestation. Yeah.
And reforestation. So we've got to, we now just need to harness that data that's coming on board and link it to financial products, cheaper loans, insurance products payouts. And now you start seeing how we might be able to make this change quickly.
Yeah, you cannot really hide from a satellite, which is probably a good thing.
Exactly. From our purposes, anyway, yeah,
for this part. There are very creepy things you can do with it as well. But I want to thank you so much, Sean. I want to be conscious of your time. Thank you for your time and sharing this morning. I'll definitely be checking in, obviously, on the frameworks coming out over the next months and over the next year, and see hopefully many more climate bonds and green bonds focus on the land use and agriculture sector.
Thanks, Cohen. Thank you very much for the time today.
You just listened to an interview with Sean Kidney of the Climate Bonds Initiative. I hope you learned something about the bond market and how to put it to work in regenerative agriculture.
If you found the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast valuable, there are a few simple ways you can use to support it. Number one, rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. That's the best way for other listeners to find the podcast, and it only takes a few seconds. Number two, share this podcast on social media or email it to your friends and colleagues. Number three, if this podcast has been of value to you and if you have the means, please join my Patreon community to help grow this platform and allow me to take it further. You can find all the details on patreon.com/regenerativeagriculture or in the description below. Thank you so much and see you at the next podcast.